All right, on our seven-part outline, we are is still in part one. The Lord is King, chapters 1 through 12. Last time, we began chapter 5, and we did a good part of chapter 5, titled A Worthless Vineyard. And up until this point, we've kind of gone through two cycles before we get to chapter 5, where Isaiah has warned about judgment coming on the people, but then he's talked about the beautiful result. The most noteworthy one was the first five verses of chapter 2, the famous passage, the nations will beat their swords into plowshares. It's a beautiful view. This third time, there's not going to be a beautiful result. It's just simply warning and doom being pronounced. Now, Isaiah has an interesting way of going about this particular prophecy. He's going to sing a song. And one commentator suggested that perhaps he sang this song at one of their grape harvest festivals. And you can imagine a grape harvest would be a time of great joy. Everyone's having a good time. They've worked hard, but they've got all the grapes squeezed, all the juice is in the bottles, and they can now celebrate. And it'd be a time when people bring out their guitars or lutes or whatever they played back then, and sing some ballads and all. And so Isaiah says, "Let me sing now for my well-beloved a song of my beloved." Who is Isaiah's well-beloved?
God.
It's God. Now, if you've read much of the Old Testament, I think you would agree that's pretty bold. That's just not the normal way that people refer to God. But it is very accurate. God was Isaiah's well-beloved. And it was the love that Isaiah had for God that kept him going through these difficult times. In the next chapter, we're going to see when God commissions Isaiah. And he tells Isaiah to do a very thankless task, just a very discouraging task. But Isaiah loved God. And he was willing to put up with a lot for the sake of his love. But this particular song is unusual, because it's usually when you sing a song for your well-beloved, it's about how wonderful your well-beloved is, how you love this person. You just cannot get him or her out of your mind, all of this. But here Isaiah is singing a song about his well-beloved's vineyard, which is certainly putting it on the fringe of love songs. But again, if this was, if, as the commentators suggest, maybe this was at the grape harvest festival, people would be, okay, well, let's hear about your beloved's vineyard. And we noticed last week that this is not the first time in the book of Isaiah that the term vineyard is used. If we go back to chapter 3, verse 14, in one of the warning passages, judgment passages, addressed to the leaders, "It is you who have devoured the vineyard. The plunder of the poor is in your houses." So we've seen this metaphor before, but in chapter 5, it gets fleshed out. We really see the picture of a vineyard. And so, as we go back to chapter 5, in verse 2, "He dug it around, he removed its stones, he planted it with the choicest vine, and he built a tower in the middle of it, and also hewed out a wine vat in it." This is a great vineyard. This is not just a slapdash effort. just plant a few vines. Let's just see what happens. And if we get some grapes, good. Then maybe we'll put a fence around it or something. I mean, everything is just well done. I mean, this is kind of like today when you have the factory farms, where you have a big company that buys a farm. They put in the best equipment. Everything is perfect because they know how to make money with this land, and they're going to do that. And so God is doing that with the vineyard. Everything, nothing but the best for his vineyard. And then, of course, he expected it to produce good grapes, but to produce only worthless ones. So that sets the scene. And in verses 3 through 6, God then speaks. I assume this is all part of the song. And I don't know whether Isaiah knew how to play the lute or whatever, but I think this is all a ballad he's singing. And people listening to it for the first time are probably thinking, what is going on? This is pretty strange. And then God speaks. And in verse 3 he says, judge between me and my vineyard. So the hearers are asked to kind of be the jury and the judge here and determine, what's to be done. Now we also know that they're also the guilty party, which is very strange to have God ask the guilty party to be the judge. But it shows you just how obvious it is. I mean, there's some things, there's some crimes people do that even the criminal has to admit, yeah, I am guilty. And so God is asking the guilty party, judge. And so he asks them this question, what more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done for it? In other words, whose fault is this? God is asking the people, you judge, what did I do wrong? What more could I have done? And clearly the answer is, well, you didn't do anything wrong. You did everything you could do for a vineyard. It's not your fault. But if God has done everything he possibly can, what is left to be done? And that's just a frightening thought here. A very frightening thought. So all that's left in verses 5 and 6 is judgment. So here's what he says. So now let me tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge and it will be consumed. I will break down its wall and it will become trampled ground. I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up. I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. So God now, instead of being the owner who cares about his vineyard, God is the enemy. He hates his vineyard. Damage, destroy. And now Isaiah explains in verse 7, for the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his delightful plant. Now, we talked last week when we did, this is all review, we talked last week when we did these verses that there are a number of places in the Bible where the people of God are compared to a vineyard or vines in a vineyard. Can anyone name me some other places you can think of where this same kind of picture is found? Matthew?
Thank you. Jesus' parable.
Yeah, Jesus told the parable of the unrighteous tenants, the guy that made a vineyard and then he rented it out to tenants and expected them to give rent and they decided they wanted it for themselves. That's one, yeah. There's one not quite like this, but it's obviously very closely related where Jesus says, I am the vine and you are the branches. Abide in me and you can bear much fruit. It's all based upon this idea here. And so, now that we're explaining what it's about, the vineyard is the house of Israel, so we'll look at the fruit he expects. He says, thus he looked for justice, but behold bloodshed, for righteousness, but behold a cry of distress. Why does anyone plant a vineyard? Yeah, Laura? Yeah, to get fruit. Yeah, the same reason you plant. You know, you're probably going to plant a garden at your new place. You expect fruit from this garden. And so, what kind of fruit did God expect from the people of Israel?
Justice and righteousness.
Justice and righteousness. Yeah. Now, we talked last week that in the Hebrew there's a wordplay between the word justice and bloodshed, and between righteousness and cry of distress. And so one of the commentators, Kidner, suggests he looked for right, but behold riot, to try to get where you see the point. Now, let me ask this question. Are we today a vineyard of God? Yeah, we are. So what does God expect of us? How does this parable apply to us? Tim?
He expects good fruit. Jesus used that in John chapter 15. I'm the vine, you are the branches. Every branch that bears fruit,
he prunes.
So that it bears more fruit.
Yeah.
Every branch that doesn't bear fruit, he cuts off and burns up.
So give me some examples in our lives today of things we could do to bear fruit for God.
Teaching others the
gospel. Yeah.
Teaching others the gospel.
Teaching others the gospel. Okay, yeah. That's not primary, but that is very important. When I say it's not primary, that what you're saying is very important after we do some other things. All right.
Should live a righteous and holy life, shine your light.
Yeah, yeah. And if we do that, then we can do what Amanda is suggesting. We can tell others about the gospel. Yeah. You ever seen someone that got it reversed? Tell the gospel first, then work on their life later? How far do they get? I've seen people. I wish I could pay them to keep their mouth shut about Jesus. It just does so much damage. Years ago, I was in college, and a friend of mine and I decided to knock on doors in the neighborhood and see if we could get people interested in the gospel. And we got to one street, and people started mentioning, you know, oh, there's somebody on this street that goes to, you know, one of your churches. And we finally found the person. This person hadn't been to church in years, but telling all the neighbors all about Jesus. Please don't do that. If you're not going to bear fruit, just don't. Just pretend you're not even part of the vineyard. Yeah. So yeah, the righteous life. Does anyone remember the judgment scene Jesus told about what people are going to be judged on in the last day? Yeah, Matthew.
He said, "I was thirsty and you gave me a drink. I was hungry and you fed me."
Yeah, he's talking about exactly what Isaiah is talking about here. Caring for people in need. And that's what God wants us to be doing today. We are people who love the people God loves. You know, I was sick, you took care of me. I was in prison, you visited me. All these things. And then, of course, when we read the book of Acts, we find out, wow, I mean, these people were selling their property to take care of the poor widows. They were really a good vineyard in those early chapters in the book of Acts. So, yeah, this is something that I think it helps motivate us. It certainly motivates me when I think of this, that God has not put me here on this earth to have a good time, to live it up. I mean, I'm not saying God wants me to be miserable, but God put me here to do a work. And this work is to show the fruit of the Spirit to people around us. Some other thoughts? Yeah, Laura.
The writer of Hebrews uses a very similar but slightly different picture when he talks about land. He talks about it as the soil that receives the blessing of
the rain
of God and produces either a good crop or thorns and thistles.
Yeah, that's in Hebrews chapter 6. And that's actually a very scary passage because it's warning. If you are land that God has watered with His Holy Spirit and you're just producing thorns and thistles, you're only good for one thing, and that's to be burned. And again, looking at the picture, I mean, if you have an acre of land that you'd like to use for something useful and all it has is thorns and thistles on it, you start by burning all the thorns and thistles off, and then maybe you can do something with it. Yeah, but again, the picture is bearing fruit. Yeah, God's looking for fruit. Other thoughts on this? All right, well, we'll continue with our review then. And this next page, we've titled Bad Fruit Part 1 because I couldn't fit the whole thing on one screen. And this is verses 8 through 17. The rest of it goes all the way through verse 25. And in this section, verses 8 through 25, there are six of a specific word found that's not a word you would want to hear addressed to yourself. What is that?
Whoa.
Whoa, yeah. What does whoa mean? And don't tell me it means stop. What is
it? It means like how unpleasant it was going to be for such a person.
Yeah. Yeah, this is really bad. It's kind of like, I really feel sorry for you. You know, and if a prophet tells you, I really feel sorry for you, this is not what you want to hear. So there's six of these in this section. Two of them on this screen, four on the next screen. And after the first two, there are two therefore sections where God says what He's going to do because of these woes He's pronounced. So after the first two, there's two therefores. After the next four, there's another two therefores. So you first find out what's going wrong with the people, and then you find out what God's going to do about it. And the two match, as we will see. So the first two on this screen have to do with the abuse of the material benefits of life. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there is no more room so that you have to live alone in the midst of the land. It's quite a picture, isn't it? These people are so greedy for land. I want all the land. I read about one lady that said, you know, I'm not that greedy. I just want my own land and then the parts that touch it. Well, that's the way these people were. They were able to somehow steal from the poor people all the land around them until they had one house, a big mansion in the middle, and you couldn't see another dwelling anywhere on the horizon. You're dwelling alone in the midst of the land. We talked when we introduced the book of Isaiah, we talked about how Isaiah began his ministry right at the tail end of the wealthiest time of the people of God, both Judah and Israel. In Judah, the king was Uzziah. In Israel, the king was Jeroboam II. Under that, at that particular time, not necessarily through thanks to those two kings, but at that particular time, it was a time where there were no world empires beating on them, and they became very prosperous, conquered all the nations around them. They ended up with about how much land there was in the days of Solomon, which is saying a lot. And of course, you can imagine, you know, without enemies beating on you, there would be a time of prosperity, and it was. Business was going great. The rich were getting richer, and what was happening to the poor? They were just getting poorer. Because the richer the people got, the more they could abuse their wealth to take advantage of the poor people. They could abuse it by means of bribery for the officials. They could abuse it by means of loans with high interest rates, and so eventually you get the guy's property. he hadn't planned to sell his property. He was just borrowing some money to make ends meet. And then there's another woe I want to look at. Down to verse 11, this is the second woe. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening that wine may inflame them. So the first one was using their riches to get wealthy in terms of land. The second one is using their riches just to pamper themselves. My money is to entertain me. That was their view. And entertain they did. So he says in verse 12, their banquets are accompanied by lyre and harp, by tambourine and flute, and by wine. These are the kind of parties people love to go to. I mean, you got a good band, you got the wine flowing. Wow, this is just great. And rich people can do that. And they did. But they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of His hands. Yeah. I mean, how many parties are there going on in Bangor where the partygoers would just love for you to step in and say, let's talk a little bit about God right now, what He would like us to do. That's not what they're there for. It was the same thing back in the days of Isaiah. Therefore, all right, I promise this. Here's the first of two therefores on this screen, and then on the next screen there will again be two therefores, although, as we'll see, we'll have to kind of search with a magnifying glass to find one, but that's the fault of the translators. We'll get to that. These therefores are direct answers to the problems that we saw with the woes. So, in this case, therefore, my people go into exile. Now, this is a direct answer to, back in verse 5, woe to those who add house to house and join field to field. These people were just living it up on the land. Give me more land, give me more land. God's therefore is, I'm going to take you away from the land. You're going into exile. You're not going to have anything. And then the second half of this is, and their honorable men are famished, and their multitude is parched with thirst. And when you think of thirst, we go back to verse 11, how these people love to drink their wine and their strong drink. So God's answer to people who are self-indulgent, getting up in the morning just to drink some more wine, His answer is, you're going to be thirsty, you're going to be famished. So the punishment fits the crime, so to speak. And then in verse 14, we have the second, therefore. Therefore, Sheol has enlarged its throat and opened its mouth without measure. What is Sheol? Yep, the abode of the dead, that's right. So you could kind of paraphrase it. Therefore, the grave has enlarged its throat and opened its mouth. He is obviously personifying something. I mean, Sheol is not a person. It doesn't have a mouth and all of this. But poetically, it's eating people. And it never is satisfied. And that's kind of the picture here. But, verse 16, the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment, and the holy God will show Himself holy in righteousness. What does holy mean? Set apart. God is separate. He is separate from us. But especially, He is separate from sin. And He is set apart in righteousness. God is going to be righteous. His people are being very unrighteous, and God cannot have fellowship with such behavior. So when God judges this, when He sends these people into exile for their land grabbing, when he gives them famine and thirst in exchange for their drunkenness, He is showing Himself as righteous. He is showing Himself as holy. And so this first two woes and two therefores ends with this verse 17. Then the lambs will graze as in their pasture, and strangers will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. We talked last week about how, at first glance, this looks like just an idyllic scene. You know, you just picture these lambs off in the distance and all this. But then the strangers and the waste places, and you realize this is a description of the land deserted of its inhabitants. You just have animals or strangers that happen to be passing through. That's what's going to happen to these people. They're on the promised land God had promised to Abraham, but they're not bearing fruit. And the consequence is they're going to be taken into exile, and the land's just going to be barren of humanity. Now that's all been reviewed. Any questions or other thoughts on the review part? So now we're going to look at the rest of this section, verses 18 through 25. This is the second half of the bad fruit section. And in this half, there's going to be four more woes followed by two more therefores. So let me read the verses, and then we'll look in detail. Starting in verse 18. Woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood, and sin as if with cart ropes, who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work that we may see it, and let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass that we may know it. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. Therefore, as a tongue of fire consumes stubble and dry grass collapses into the flame, so their root will become like rot and their blossom blow away as dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. On this account, the anger of the Lord has burned against his people, and he has stretched out his hand against them and struck them down. And the mountains quaked, and their corpses lay like refuse in the middle of the streets. For all this, his anger is not spent, but his hand is still stretched out. Now these woes, in the first half, the woes had to do with the abuse of the material benefits of life. Basically abusing money. In this half, they are violations of the people's moral and spiritual obligations. So he begins with, woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood and sin as if with cart ropes. Now, what would you normally tie a cart to with ropes?
Horse or donkey or
not. Yeah, a horse, a donkey, some kind of a draft animal. So these people have become like animals. They're pulling this cart, but what does the cart represent?
Their sins.
Their sins, yeah. Which is quite a picture. I don't know if anyone watched one of the many productions of the Christmas Carol this past season, but in the Christmas Carol you've got the dead Marley who comes dragging in a chain with a big bunch of money boxes behind him, and he says, I forged this chain in life. Well, this is the picture is being given here. These people are dragging sin behind them like an animal drags a cart. That's a lot of sin. Sin is just what they are. That's what they stand for. So instead of being men in God's image, they become animals. And then, still in this first woe, who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work that we may see it, and let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass that we may know it. Would you recommend talking like this to God? This is pretty arrogant, isn't it? Bring it on, God, we're ready. Yeah, Matthew.
Well, I mean, we are told, you know, to say, oh Lord, come, you know, in the New Testament, but it's just, are we ready?
Are we ready, yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, I'm afraid there are a lot of people today that are saying, "Oh Lord, come," that aren't ready for Him to come and don't understand that. But anyway, this is just over the top, is this attitude. You know, let God show us. All right, the next woe, verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. So they're rewriting God's moral code. And of course, this is up to date. I mean, sinners today are doing the exact same thing. There's things that many in our society today will tell you, oh, this is a good thing. And it's just as sinful as it can be. And there are things in our society that these same people will tell you, this is a terrible thing. And yet it's really a good thing. It's just turned it upside down. And that's what this woe is about. Calling evil good and good evil. And then it's kind of like we're sort of descending a staircase toward the bottom here. Because the next one is even worse. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. You know, the more people go into sin, the more they do this. Sin begets arrogance. And we watch. I mean, you watch someone go in, you know, go down that staircase, and you just see them becoming more and more foolish with each thing they do. And yet they become more and more arrogant. I am so wise. Wow. So woe to those people. And then the third woe. This is the fourth woe. Verse 22. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink. This is really right up to date. It is... these worldly people that love to go to these parties, they brag about how much wine they can hold, you know. And being able to take a lot of drinks and still stand on your own on 2 feet to them is a sign that, you know, you're really something. So they're heroes. They're heroes in drinking wine. And valiant men in mixing strong drink. And again, if someone wants to show themselves to really sophisticated, they'll show you how to mix a fancy drink. You know, I learned this one over when I was in Morocco. You know, and they'll start dumping in the alcoholic beverages and, you know, the lime and whatever else that you need to do to make this drink. And everyone's, oh wow, you know, he is so cool. That's what this is describing. And all God can say is, that's pretty sad. That's really sad. Verse 23, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. These are the same people. I mean, these people that can hold their liquor and know how to mix a fancy drink, they're the judges, they're the leaders of the land. And they dispense justice to the highest bidder. And the ones who are in the right, they just condemn. This is just tragic. So drinking heroes are the nation's judges, not a good thing. All right, any questions or thoughts on the woes before I start the therefores here? We've had four woes. All right, therefore number one, verse 24. As a tongue of fire consumes stubble and dry grass collapses into the flame, so their root will become like rot and their blossom blow away as dust. So God's talking about a grass fire coming along. And I think this is an answer to verse 19, who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work that we may see it. There's not much faster than a grass fire. So they want speed. God says, okay, I'll give you something that's really, really fast. A fire that's going to burn everything up. Wow. Well, we didn't think it was a great idea when they suggested in the first place. This is the consequence. For they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Now, you remember, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. When they're doing that, they're not only rejecting God's law, but they're despising the Holy One of Israel. This is that phrase that's found dozens of times in the book of Isaiah. God is someone that should be respected, he should be reverenced, he should not be despised. And when you call evil good and good evil, you're despising the Holy God. All right, now verse 25. On this account, nearly every other translation puts the word therefore here. It's the very same Hebrew word that was used for therefore before. I was studying this and I was reading these commentaries that were saying, you know, there's two therefores after the four woes. And I was looking, I'm only finding one. I did a computer search. There's only one in there. Until I started looking at the other translations. So I'm a little bit disappointed with the New American Standard here. I don't know why they decided they needed to use a different phrase. You know, sometimes I think translators think, it's getting too boring. We've had the word therefore too many times here. Anyway, this is a therefore. The second therefore in the second set of therefores. And I'll read this out of verse 25. And has stretched out his hand against them and struck them down, and the mountains quaked, and their corpses lay like refuse in the middle of the streets. Now the way this is phrased here, it sounds like it's already happened. I can't guarantee that, but it may well be that this is something that's happened. Possibly it's a terrible earthquake. We do read about an earthquake. I think it's in the book of Amos. He mentions it, who wrote around the same time. So this may already be an example of what God is doing because of their attitude, rejecting the law of God and despising the Holy One of Israel. So you get the earthquake. It's really terrible. I mean, we've seen things happen in our nation that have been terrible. The worst natural disaster I can think of in well, there's been two different hurricanes. So there was Katrina that wiped out New Orleans, and there was one in Houston that did a huge amount of damage. And we see these, and they are evidences of God's anger against sin. And then this next phrase says, for all this, his anger is not spent, but his hand is still stretched out. It's not done. God is still angry. There's more judgment yet to come. So we've had six woes. We've had four therefores, all of them terrifying. But at the very end, there's more to come. His anger is not spent. Yeah, Matthew.
Back on the fourth woe there about the strong drink and also the fact that those guys are the leaders, that reminds me of the 31st chapter of Proverbs, when he says it's not for kings, O Lemuel, to
drink wine, yeah.
Because they're supposed to dispense justice.
Yeah, that's a good point. So you're showing a connection between going after wine and doing the bribery in the next verse. And that's true. Wine takes away a person's judgment. Yeah, good thoughts. Some other thoughts on this screen? Alright. So the next screen finishes the chapter. We've titled it The Vineyard Ravaged, verses 26 through 30. So let me read those verses. He will also lift up a standard to the distant nation and will whistle for it from the ends of the earth. And behold, it will come with speed swiftly. No one in it is weary or stumbles. None slumbers or sleeps, nor is the belt at its waist undone, nor its sandal strap broken. Its arrows are sharp, and all its bows are bent. The hoofs of its horses seem like flint, and its chariot wheels like a whirlwind. Its roaring is like a lioness, and it roars the young lions. It growls as it seizes the prey and carries it off with no one to deliver it. And it will growl over it in that day like the roaring of the sea. If one looks to the land, behold, there is darkness and distress. Even the light is darkened by its clouds. So verse 26, He will also lift up a standard to the distant nation and will whistle for it from the ends of the earth, and behold, it will come with speed swiftly. Now, I never did learn how to do that two-fingered whistle, but this is what I picture God doing. He puts his two fingers in his mouth, and he blows, and there's this shrill whistle, and this nation comes running up, you call? That's the picture here. Which is a pretty dramatic picture. And in the reality, of course, the nation was probably the nation of Assyria that God was whistling for. And yet if you asked, you know, Sennacherib or one of the other kings of Assyria, you know, why are you coming down here to Judah to attack it? Did God whistle for you? I think he would have said, huh? But behind the scenes, that's what's going on. God whistled and he came. And you remember back here in verse 19, these people were saying, let him make speed, let him hasten his work that we may see it. This verse is another answer to that. This nation will come with speed swiftly. Now that's a lot of speed if it's speed swiftly. All right, then I'm going to jump down to verse 29. It growls as it seizes the prey and carries it off with no one to deliver it. He's picturing the enemy as a lion here, growling over the prey. If a lion kills, a deer or something of that size, and is growling over it, who would dare go take that prey away from it? You don't mess with a lion when it's in that kind of a mood. And that's the picture of this enemy that God is going to whistle for. No one's going to take the prey away from them. This is much I want to cover on this screen. So any other thoughts on this screen before we go? All right, I can just introduce this one. We're almost out of time here, but the next section we're going to do is I saw the Lord. It's the whole of chapter 6. And this is one of the mountain peaks in the book of Isaiah. I can only think of one other chapter in Isaiah that's, would rival it as terms of a mountain peak. That would be Isaiah 53. But this one, and really in the whole Old Testament, it's one of the mountain peaks there. Just if you were going to name some of the most exalted chapters in the Old Testament, this would have to be one of them. And now we would think about it. We would think like Exodus chapters 19 and 20, where God came down on Mount Sinai and it was earthquakes and fire and all this. That was certainly one of those great mountain peaks. But this is going to be right up there. It's like the mountaintop experience that Moses had when he told God, show me your glory. And we don't read Isaiah asking for that, but that's exactly what he's going to see here. Isaiah gets a vision of God. In the entire Bible, there's not more than, half a dozen or so times when anyone had a vision of God. Moses had one, Ezekiel, Isaiah, John in the book of Revelation, the few more like that. But it's very rare. And yet, the chapter is going to tell us more than just what Isaiah saw and what God did toward Isaiah. The chapter is really a picture of how God is going to move this sinful nation into the wonderful situation he described in chapter 2. I mean, we read chapter 2, in the last days all the nations will come to the mountain of the Lord. And after the chapter we just finished, we're thinking, a lot of chance there is of that ever happening with these people to work with. Isaiah chapter 6 is giving us a picture of how God's going to accomplish that. And so we'll look forward to studying that next time. Any last thoughts for this morning? I appreciate everyone's help this morning.